In the following lecture, Father John Hardin, S.J., speaks on the subject, Religious Maturity, What It Is and How to Develop It. Father Hardin.
I would like to cover this under four parts. First, the meaning of religious maturity, then its qualities, thirdly, its distinctive features, in other words, what is unique or different about religious maturity as compared with other aspects of the religious life, and then the principal means by which a person can become religiously mature. First, a definition of religious maturity. I would define religious maturity as the condition of Christ-likeness that a person reaches through cooperation with divine grace. Religious maturity is the condition of Christ-likeness that a person reaches through cooperation with divine grace. It is, as we know, a matter of revelation that Christ is the perfect human being, a divine person, but totally human. Religious maturity, therefore, is the approximation in us of that human perfection possessed by the Son of God, who became the Son of Mary. Saint Paul speaks of our reaching the fullness of the stature of Christ. Consequently, whatever else religious maturity means, it means the composite of all those virtues which Christ possessed as man and which we as human beings can not only imitate but gradually duplicate. One of the less well-known features of the imitation of Christ is that its goal is duplication. Imitation is a process. Duplication is the goal. Imitation is the means. Duplication is the end. In other words, what God wants is that having sent his only begotten Son in human form, he wants the followers of Christ to become not only imitators of Christ, but duplicators of Christ. So that what Christ wants by nature, since he was God, we should become by grace. I can tell you that a proper understanding of religious maturity opens up a vast new vista in the religious life, because it is this maturity that we are to reach in our lives by the time we die, and then what Saint Paul especially insists, we are to retain for all eternity. Christian perfection is not, though it includes this, it is not only or mainly a means of saving our souls. It is that we might become more and more like Christ in this life, so as to be like Christ in the life to come. We are all naturally so preoccupied, beginning with the speaker, with making it. If you're like me, we're scared. Will I make it? And we can have our eyes so closely fixed on what we call the finishing line that we may overlook there's a whole eternity stretching ahead of us. One of the main reasons for becoming as holy as possible, which means as Christ-like as possible now, is that we might remain as Christ-like as possible in eternity, because we won't become, now this is a strange statement, we won't become any holier after we die than we are when we die. Don't you think this is worth saying? Merit ceases with the end of our mortal life. God is thereby more glorified the more we become like His own divine Son, whose human existence on earth is, I repeat, not only to be a pattern of how we are to live here, but what we are to remain hereafter. So much for the meaning. Now the qualities. I have five, but I could have multiplied this times five. One thing we must keep in mind when we talk about the qualities of religious maturity is to make sure that we are talking about those qualities in Christ which He had and which we are to both imitate and in the process duplicate. There are certain things that Christ did not have which we do. First, prayerful intimacy with God. In other words, the first quality of religious maturity is that intimacy with God, which we call prayerfulness, that Christ experienced mainly because He was the Son of God in human form, and that we are to try to, as I keep repeating, both imitate and duplicate. I use the word intimacy when I talk about prayerful intimacy with God. Did Christ have to pray? No. Did Christ have to ask for graces that He needed? No. Did Christ have sins to expiate, which He had to beg God's mercy to obtain? No. Among the four traditional forms of prayer, adoration, gratitude, petition, and expiation, which one of these four was most typical of Christ in His practice of prayer? Adoration, gratitude, petition, or expiation? Adoration. Consequently, on this first level of the qualities of spiritual or religious maturity, it is Christ's intimacy with God which, when carried into practice consciously and voluntarily, becomes prayer. On this level, Christ is very imitable, even though he did not have to pray. Secondly, the quality of habitual readiness to do God's will. A religiously mature person, therefore, not only does God's will, he is not only ready to do God's will, but is habitually ready to do God's will. This habitual readiness is a disposition of will. In other words, where a person who is less mature may be more or less ready to do God's will, the sign of religious maturity is of that disposition of will which is so bent, you might say, on doing God's will that there is no longer in that human will the urge or the desire to do one's own will contrary to God's will. Third, zeal to make God known and faithfully served. A religiously mature person is zealous. In what way? Zealous to make God known and to have God faithfully served. By whom? By others. In other words, religious maturity never stops with self-sanctification. Indeed, it measures its own holiness by the degree of zeal that a person has to make God known, in other words, to proclaim, as the present Pope is telling us, to proclaim Christ and to have him faithfully served. It has been said, and I would say accurately, that religious maturity, not unlike natural or physical maturity, is reached when a person has gone beyond the stage of infancy or childhood, and indeed beyond adolescence into procreative adulthood. Maturity in the physical order means having the capacity to reproduce oneself. This third quality of religious maturity might be called the capacity to reproduce oneself supernaturally, or spiritual procreativity. And just as in the natural, physical order, a person is said to be mature when he or she is capable of reproducing themselves. This is also true in the supernatural order. There is a zeal. That zeal in the order of grace corresponds to the desire for reproduction in the order of nature. Am I clear? In the absence of this zeal, no matter how good or holy a person may be, well, in the ordinary course of providence, that holiness will remain in that person. Now, the strong impulse that we have naturally to reproduce ourselves is shown in a person who has religious maturity by wanting to reproduce him or herself supernaturally. Over the centuries, as all the church's spiritual masters point out, whatever is true in the order of nature is correspondingly, but on a much higher level, true of the order of grace. We can speak of a child, an infant. We speak of growing up. We speak of being grown up. And one of the marks of being grown up naturally is both the capacity and the desire to reproduce oneself. This is human nature. So in the order of grace, we grow from infancy through childhood through what we might call spiritual adolescence into spiritual adulthood, one of whose marks, and it's my third one, is reproductivity. Brother?
Father, this corresponds so well to point number one about imitation and duplication. Actually, what we want to do is reproduce the Christ in us to others. Is that correct?
First in ourselves. In other words, I must be
that's the duplication.
A normal, healthy human being. In fact, now I could push this analogy quite far. By and large, and we're now discovering, for example, with the number of men, but women especially, say, on drugs, how this affects their offspring, right? By and large, a healthy parent reproduces a healthy child. And one reason that, naturally speaking, it is discouraged from, say, having youngsters in their early teens marrying is that their offspring are often, and this is a matter of history, are weak. A mother at 15 is just not fully mature. You follow the analogy? You're right, brother, but remember, we cannot underestimate, we dare not, the need for concentrating on our own supernatural health and well-being, so that when we are to begin to reproduce ourselves in others, we better reproduce healthy offspring. But note, zeal is especially in the order of the will. It's the desire that I want to make God known and faithfully served. And what is the apostate except to make God known and faithfully served? Number four, fourth quality of this religious maturity, selfless love of others. Most of my knowledge of children is vicarious. It's what people have told me about children. I've watched them on occasion. They fascinate me when I see them on the subways. But I am told that children are notoriously selfish. Am I correct? They don't even realize how selfish they are. In little things, but it's little things that make big things. Have got to be taught how to share, have got to be taught how to be grateful, have got to be taught how to well, put up with others whom they perhaps may not particularly like, not to allow their selfishness to project itself. And I've watched it, and I've heard it, a child screaming because the mother took something from it which the child wanted. Now, just as in the natural order, we have to grow in becoming less and less selfish, so through grace, we become mature as we become more selfless. But at this point, all that Christ taught us, especially, and there are two Gospels, that the whole Gospel, practically, of Luke and John, deals with this selfless love of others. In Luke's Gospel, Christ is especially stressing loving our enemies, otherwise known as the people we don't like. And the reason is because we think they don't like us. That, by the way, is the logic of hatred. I think someone does not love me. So what does she expect of me? She doesn't expect me to love her. So then, I don't love her. And once that chain reaction starts, I see all kinds of things in the other person that fortify and rationalize what I find unlovable in that individual. We are prone to excuse even the worst sins in people we like. We are prone to find fault with everything in people we don't like. The key is our will. Now, religious maturity goes beyond natural maturity. Religious maturity builds on grace. And therefore, it not only learns how to be less and less selfish, but with the help of God, how to be more and more generous. In other words, the capacity to give of oneself to others is the surest mark of religious maturity. That does not exclude prudence. It does not exclude all the, you might say, elevated common sense. We don't go around embracing everybody in sight. We've got to watch, for example, how we look at some people. We don't always smile at people we love, because the husband or wife of that person may misunderstand it. All of this and a thousand things unsaid come into play. But in essence, selfless love of others, where I give of myself, is, I would say, by and large, the most easily recognizable sign of religious maturity. But I would like to add, this selfless love of others must be prudent. And I don't believe there is anywhere that you can more easily distinguish between, call it natural, spontaneous, well, kindness, and supernatural generosity. Love in both cases, giving of self in both cases, but nature is notoriously imprudent. Grace is very wise. We are to love others wisely. And I think more harm has been done in the world by unwisely loving people than perhaps in any other way. Finally, a quality of this religious maturity is the redemptive love of the cross. The redemptive love of the cross. Each of these five, needless to say, are characteristic of Christ, imitable by us, and reflective of his humanity, minus those parts of our humanity which Christ as man did not possess. He had no sin. He had no sinful concupiscence. He didn't have to believe or trust because he had the divine vision. Nevertheless, he was truly human. And most mysteriously, he had a profoundly redemptive love of the cross. That's an odd combination of words. Notice, the religiously mature person is not merely one, say, who doesn't mind suffering. The ancient Stoics could put up with a lot of suffering. The Zen Buddhists, or in general the Oriental world, has a capacity for suffering that the Western world reads about but has not experienced. But that's not enough. It is not mere endurance of pain, as though there's something inherently good in suffering. It is suffering as the cross. What is the cross? The cross is suffering accepted. Pain plus the will equals the cross. Every human being suffers. We enter the world crying, and we leave it unless we're drugged into insensibility in a spasm of pain. But not everyone bears the cross. It takes the will to make the cross out of suffering. But that's not all. Christ not only suffered, he was not only willing to suffer, which defines the cross. He loved the cross. And that we have on the words of Revelation, having joy set before him, he chose the cross. Again, prudence. This is not a matter of looking for the hardest things and choosing them by preference because they are harder. It must be according to God's will. For example, I naturally like to sleep. But I got into the habit of not sleeping, at least not much. So, as I've told so many people, because I can talk about this, there's no danger of failing in charity. So, I have gradually got back into the habit of sleeping more. What is naturally more pleasant? Sleeping more or sleeping less? Well, sleeping more. so that, under obedience, I now sleep more. And this is one act of obedience, I don't mind my telling you, I enjoy. Am I making sense? To make sure that we don't misunderstand this love of the cross as though it is love of suffering. Get it? It must be willed by God. This is very basic. And again, very good people. And this is, I believe, under demonic temptation. Undertake things beyond their strength and either wear themselves out before their time or become crotchety and cranky and hard to live with because they haven't either had a good meal, so they read another book, another volume of St. John of the Cross, on how to mortify their bodies. What they need to be told, they should eat a good breakfast, about which St. John of the Cross says nothing. In other words, we've got to be prudent in our desire for suffering.
Yes.
And it can differ from one day to the next. It differs from one person to another. And in dealing with people, some can take more and some can take less.
As a matter of fact, Father, I think in the rule of Saint Benedict, Saint Benedict describes prudence as the mother of virtue.
That's true, because unless it is prudent, though it may be well intended, unless prudence, as it were, bears this virtue, unless this virtue is her offspring, it can go into all kinds of aberrations. And I see this. Take, for example, now, some overzealous people realizing the problems we've got in the church, so they want to correct everything overnight. They become angry and they can take it out on others. They can use words. They can say things that in their righteous indignation take the difference between a man like Savonarola and a man like, don't say, St. Dominic. Savonarola was a Dominican. Savonarola was imprudent in his zeal to correct the evils of his day. The key word is redemptive. It's the redemptive love of the cross. In God's mysterious providence, the purpose of the cross, whether Christ's or ours, is to redeem souls. When is my love of the cross what God wants it to be? When it is redemptive. When souls are redeemed by the example that I give, by the effort that I expend, by the merit that I gain, but it is a redemptive love of the cross. And frankly, unless this redemptive dimension is in it, after a while people will begin to ask themselves, why should I carry the cross or carry it any longer? And it is especially in enduring the cross at the hands or the eyes or the lips of others that then becomes redemptive for the very persons who cause me the pain. This, by the way, is the principal theme of the Holy Father's latest encyclical, Dives in Misericordia. God, who is rich in mercy, which is what the expression means, showed us what mercy means by suffering and dying at the hands of those whom he came to redeem. And this, insofar as we become Christ-like, is to be our lot in life, to suffer and die at the hands of those whom with Christ we are to help redeem. This was brought home to me last night as I was getting off the bus at LaGuardia. I timed myself carefully, gave myself an hour and a half from Manhattan to LaGuardia by public transportation. The taxi is now $14 from Manhattan to LaGuardia, and that's more than I as a religious should spend. So I take three pieces of transportation, public transportation. I time myself. The third piece of transportation is a bus. First two are trains. The bus driver was 10 minutes late in leaving the bus station from where I got off the train, which meant that I was afraid I'd miss the plane leaving at 8:30 from New York. So as we got near to the LaGuardia station, there was a lot of traffic, and I knew every minute counts. So I got to the front door where the bus driver was, and he shouted at me, "Get away from that door." Well, yeah, there were all the way in from the train station to the airport, all kinds of people had been standing next to the door. When, you know, when you want to get off, you stand near the door. So I stepped aside. And then, without a second thought, I said, "I'm already late for my plane." Well, that just made him more angry. I don't even remember all that he said. I don't want to remember. The next time you go to the airport, take a taxi. This is the bus driver talking to me. Well, I'm a priest. Anything I would have said, I think I shouldn't have said what I did, but I just wanted to tell him I'm already late for the plane, spontaneous. Would have irritated him. I want that man to remember that he insulted a priest. I wish he had more priests riding buses, dressed in clerics. On the way to Chicago, I prayed for him. You'll pardon the biographical note. I would like to think it's a little sample of redemptive love, and specifically of the cross.
Please turn over to side B and push the play button immediately without rewinding the tape.